Calling State Affairs to order, 11:38 a.m., Saturday, May 11th. Martha, will you please call the roll?
Representative Wolf?
Here.
Representative Vance?
Yes, here.
Representative Shaw? Representative Hopkins?
Here.
Representative Story?
Here.
Representative Fields? Representative Chase-Donkin?
Here. With five members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you, Martha and Eileen, for being here today on a Saturday. Please silence your cell phones. Three items on today's agenda. H.R. 11, second hearing. It's my intention to take motion on this piece of legislation. H.B. 132, second hearing, and H.B. 141, and the general sort of presentation on quarterly PFD disbursement, and we'll go in that order. First, on H.R. 11, there was an amendment deadline yesterday at 12 noon. No amendments were submitted, and I'll move to committee comment on this piece of legislation before we entertain a motion. Is there any comment on House Resolution 11? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if you know the meaning of the name. Is it Skanach? How do we write
it? Skanach.
Skanach. Do you know the meaning of that name?
Yes, we do, and I can pull it up on my phone while I do any other committee comment. This will take me 30 seconds.
I just feel it. I'm very glad you brought this forward and feel it's very appropriate.
Representative Vance, I will get back with the answer in a minute or two while we get to other legislation, and that way we can have it on the record. It's a good question. Any further comment, Representative Wohl, Representative Hopkins? Seeing none, a motion, Representative Story.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, I move that the committee report H.R. 1131-L60942/M out of committee with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Seeing and hearing no objection, House Resolution 11 moves from committee. And the paperwork will be distributed shortly while we move right along. Second item on today's agenda, House Bill 132, PFD, Dividend and Earnings Bill from Representative Wohl. Nathaniel Grabman, the staff carrying the piece of legislation. There is one amendment from Representative Fields, who is on baby duty today, unfortunately not able to be here. So we'll hold the bill, if only to hear that amendment today, although I do want to provide the opportunity for questions from the committee on HB 132. If any members have questions, or provide you, Representative Wohl, the opportunity to comment further on the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I suppose I can do it from this seat. And for those members who weren't here during the initial bill presentation, which I think at this point is only Representative Hopkins, what HB 132 does is change how we fund the PFD, or how we come up with a number for the PFD value, PFD check value. And there's a lot of talk right now about, since we haven't been following the statutory formula for a few years, to what this bill will do is eliminate that statute and come up with a new one that we can follow. There is some talk around the building of taking a percentage of the POMV, the 5% or 5.25% draw, depending on which year it is, that comes from the permanent fund, and using that, which goes to general fund, using a percentage of that for the PFD check. I personally have some problems with that, because the POMV, as a percentage of market value of the total permanent fund of $60+ billion, is probably just going to, what we're told, is increase in value over the next decades. And it's based on Wall Street, where this, my bill, will take the derive the value based on oil revenue, which to me is safer as far as funding state government is concerned, because if oil revenue's up, then state revenues are doing well, and we can afford a check of a set value. Whereas oil revenues are down, then we need the POMV money to fund the state, and then the PFD money would be reliant on oil. And I think this is an important distinction, so that if oil were to go, say, in the basement as far as revenue goes, we wouldn't be obligated to pay out a large PFD check based on Wall Street. And as one of our graphs showed last time, it tends to be when oil prices are way up, the sort of U.S. or global economy tends to decline because of the increased oil prices, although the state government does really well. And when oil prices are down, other economies do well, but ours doesn't. So there's an inverse relationship. So I think, personally, the PFD check should be tied to oil revenue. And the bill has a 33% portion to go to oil, which this year, I think, is over $1,000 in the check. But there was a request to increase that percentage to 40%, and I was going to wait for Representative Fields, who had that amendment, and that would bring it up to closer to $1,400 or $1,500 for this year. And then if oil prices went up, if production went up, if we started selling natural gas, i.e. a gas pipeline came through, the check's value would go up. Oil taxes would change the value of the check, because this gets the revenue in totality from all minerals and oil and gas. So all these things could make the check go up as well. So it's more reflective of the local Alaskan economy and not so much the global Wall Street-based economy, which the Permanent Fund is based on. So I think it's an option we should consider seriously, and I think it's something that's sustainable going into the future. But that being said, I'm happy to wait for Representative Fields to come back and offer his amendment.
Thank you, Representative Wohl. Any questions from the committee on that re-presentation, if you will? Representative Story.
I think it's a tool that we should have to look at and to keep looking at. And I was looking at one of the charts from the past and try, and so your idea based now on oil projections that we'll be having over the next few years, you feel it would be around the $1,200, $1,400 PFD size?
And thank you, Representative Story, through the chair. And I think Mr. Grabman who has more readily access and has been looking at these numbers more frequently than I have. I guess it depends which percentage we're talking about. 33% according to this chart. Mm-hmm. I'll refer to Mr. Grabman over there. So my eyes aren't so good this morning.
Mr. Grabman, please put yourself on record. Speak the question.
For the record, my name is Nathaniel Grabman, staff to Representative Wohl. Looking at the chart that I see you have in front of you, it looks like based on the numbers we have, and those are based off of revenue projections from the revenue source book from fall 2018, they would, with the 33%, continue to rise over time, but it would be kind of a steady climb. And as that chart shows, they'd go from about $1,500 in 2020, rising closer to $2,000 over that next decade.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, we'll bring this bill back when we have the amendment from Representative Fields. Not to steal his thunder, but I think that amendment jacks the percentage up to 40% for the committee's reference. So can cogitate on that in the interim. And we will set HB 132 aside in the interstitial space before the third agenda item. To your question, previously noted, Representative Vance, on the etymology of skanach, and the X with a line underneath it as a guttural, if you're wondering what the heck that character is or how to pronounce it. From the application sent to the U.S. Board on Geographic Names, the recommended name, Skanach, has been used in the region since time immemorial. Skanach refers to the name of the village on the eastern shore of the bay, a village that no longer exists and was one of the three villages bombed in 1869. And that's where the name comes from. It was the name of a community no longer existent. For the record. Moving on to the third agenda item, HB 141. This is on PFD payment schedule. This is the first hearing in this committee. I have no intention of moving this bill, but I do have intention of airing this concept, especially given the Senate's action incorporating quarterly disbursement into one of the constitutional amendments that the governor has introduced. And I think this is a subject that seems to have rising interest, and I know the governor has some interest and curiosity in this subject as well, at least as he's expressed to me. So today we have a presentation from Sidya Balakrishnan from Jain Family Institute in New York City. We also have Commissioner Tangeman in the room available to answer questions, which and maybe speak to the idea from DOR an implementation perspective, as I know DOR has had the opportunity to explore those questions. First, Mr. Balakrishnan, please put yourself on record, and if you would speak to the general subject of frequency of disbursement of permanent fund dividends, and for the committee's reference, this is Jain Family Institute has done a lot of academic research on the question of frequency of disbursement with PFD and analogous programs around the world, and the effects of different disbursement schedules. Mr. Balakrishnan.
Yes, hi. I'm Sidya. I'm the Director of Research at Jain Family Institute. We work on a lot of cash transfer guaranteed income programs, and we were asked to essentially give a comment on whether making the disbursements quarterly is a good idea. And from a pure social science perspective, the main issue which comes is the fact that people are constrained in terms of credit or savings, which essentially makes the anticipated transfer for the permanent fund dividend. So if you're getting it at the end of the year and they know that they're getting it, they plan accordingly, and that's supposed to be the ideal scenario, and they will smooth out how they're spending the money. But essentially what happens is with poor households, especially poor households, there is constraints in savings and credit. When that happens, people cannot anticipate how to spend that money. So there's a lot of literature. It's still not conclusive that more frequent transfers are better for X households. So essentially, my only conclusion or my statement here is that we don't know what kind of constraints households have. That means that especially for poor households, you need to have more frequent disbursements in order for them to smooth out their consumption for households which may not have enough credit or may be savings constrained. So in that scenario where people need money more often in order to make sure to make ends meet, that's what the literature is suggesting. So my recommendation was to have an opt-in where we have the permanent fund dividend recipients having an opt-in process where they can choose themselves, because in we as academics or researchers can keep talking about what we think is best for people, but at the end of the day, the people know best. And in order to make sure that we are able to help people with the policy that all of you are recommending, it makes more sense for us to make sure that they get the money when they need it the most.
Thank you, Ms. Balakrishnan. Apologies on the errant prefix. So in conclusion, from your perspective, looking at the body of academic research, it's ambiguous that a more frequent disbursement schedule is recommended, and you would recommend creating an opt-in option or sort of discretion for PFD recipients in terms of what their disbursement frequency would be. Is that an accurate summary?
Yes. Just a caveat there. When I said it's ambiguous, it's also because we have a very, very wide heterogeneous population. So a single disbursement can help a lot of people, especially to make large investments that can push them out of the poverty or push them out of poverty or make some sort of human capital investments. The reason I said that it's ambiguous is because people have different kinds of constraints. And for us to create a policy where we do not, how do I put this? It's essentially the way to make sure that we are able to help people as much as we can from a policy is to ensure that they have an option or they have a decision or some sort of way to make sure that they can have a choice in terms of how and how often they want the policy.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
A question.
Representative Story.
And I guess this is a question I'll leave for people to ask of the Angela Roselle, you know, how would that affect how they would do disbursements, and would that be what would the effect be on the corporation and their decisions and this time?
And Representative Stray, I think I can answer that question. I think the corporation has been clear in public statements that they don't have a position or a predilection what the disbursement schedule would be, as long as they have certainty how much cash is needed when, and that they can basically manage with that certainty. Representative Vance, did you have a question?
I was just going to ask if you have done a formal presentation on this bill before we have invited testimony.
The invited testimony is on the general question of disbursement frequency. We can do a formal presentation on the bill at some point, but Ms. Balakrishnan has studied the literature of disbursement of cash transfers. So whether it's monthly, quarterly, annually, sort of speaking or summarizing to that research.
The reason that I ask that is for the public benefit who may be trying to follow along and have an understanding from why you're bringing this bill forward and what it has to say, and then have the input, because I know that this is something that is a big issue amongst Alaskans.
Absolutely, Representative Vance. I think even one of your constituents might be very interested in this, Mr. Tillian. Is he Representative Stute's constituent?
Okay. But he claims to be from mine from time to time. But on a different note, please excuse me. I have a funeral to attend. So.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Vance. And Representative Hopkins, you're good? You have a question. Yeah, please.
And I'm sorry, ma'am, I forgot your name. I don't want to butcher it. I've got a weird first name, and I know how that goes. Mr. Balakrishnan, thank you. Are there any other social safety net programs around the country that you've seen gone from a one-time large distribution to a quarterly or monthly or smaller and more frequent distribution? Have you seen that in any other states or any federal programs, and how that might have impacted that disbursement and that program?
The EITC, there's a pilot in Chicago where they're trying to make it quarterly. So that's still ongoing. I haven't seen the evidence from that, or robust evidence from that coming up yet, but there are several. When you look at cash transfer programs, typically, or guaranteed income, because I've seen Alaska being cited a lot in the guaranteed income literature, because there you see that a lot of programs which are proposed or are ongoing, for example, in Stockton, where I work on with the team there, they're doing it monthly. So there has been I won't say a shift, but there's been an increasing political and academic attention to the frequency of transfers, and they have proposed different kinds of transfers. And again, I'm repeating, the evidence can be different for different people, but the fact that more frequent transfers will help people smooth consumption is pretty, it's clear that giving people frequent amounts of money will help them smooth consumption, especially for poor households, and you're seeing that increasingly at least in the U.S., with unconditional cash transfer programs, which is kind of where Alaska comes in terms of the literature.
Well, thank you very much. Do you follow up?
Representative Hopkins.
Do you feel that, or would this make it more of a guaranteed income, the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend? If we put it out once every quarter, would it make it more of a guaranteed income style disbursement as opposed to the one time?
So guaranteed income, again, is such a big theory that it's hard for me to answer that question. So most of the time people say frequent, unconditional, enough to sustain a certain standard of living. That's what is defined as basic income in or guaranteed income in most discourses. But at the same time, like, you could also see a lump sum transfer with the same amount of money being close to guaranteed income. It's just that we are making assumptions about how people would spend that money if they know it's coming at the end of the year in a huge chunk of money, or whether they're getting it in frequent intervals for them to plan accordingly. So it's a difficult question for me to answer, because typically, yes, guaranteed income is seen as more high frequency. But there is still, like, there are schools of thought which talk about guaranteed income in terms of the amount of money and not the frequency of money.
Thank you very much, ma'am. I appreciate your answer and your work on this project. Thank you.
Ms. Balakrishnan, could you define what you mean by consumption smoothing?
Yes. Okay. Let's take an individual who has a certain amount of money, income X, and has to decide on how to spend that money in terms of what kind of groceries, durable goods, non-durable goods, what rent they have to pay, and so on. If they know how much they're going to get in terms of anticipate. So the reason I'm using the word anticipated transfers is because it's very different from a lottery, where they don't know that they're getting that money and they'll spend it very differently, but also very well. The way to explain consumption smoothing very simply is you would plan to essentially make sure that you have the same amount of income or the same amount of consumption across a year, right? You have certain bills to pay, which you have to make payments for. So if you don't, in a scenario where you don't have debt or you don't have any savings constraints, essentially what you want to do is make sure that you have the same amount of consumption across your lifetime. So that's what consumption smoothing means. So in order to make sure that you're consuming or saving or investing in the same levels, that's essentially what we want people to do in order to not have too many shocks, too many volatilities in their income, too many volatilities in their consumption. So we want to make sure that they are able to plan ahead for their lives, and that also means that they are also consume and save in the same way in terms of knowing exactly how much they need to spend in order to make ends meet. So that's what I mean by consumption smoothing, essentially having a kind of constant trend in terms of how you're spending what you have.
Representative Hopkins.
Thanks again. Now my interest has peaked, and I apologize for keeping everyone here longer. You had talked about looking at this question in terms of a guaranteed income, which you defined as trying to guarantee everyone a quality of life or a certain level of quality of life by guaranteeing them that income. With a check that's $3,000 at most this year, $3,200 maybe, does that seem to reach a threshold that qualifies or qualifies as a living income, as a guaranteed income? Is that something that is even enough of a blip on the radar for an income to raise someone's standard of living enough to qualify as a living income or a guaranteed income?
So the short answer to that is no, it's not. But what why Alaska Permanent Fund is used in guaranteed income literature, it's the most long-standing unconditional payment, which is why people use Alaska as a reference to understand basic income. I would call it a guaranteed income, not a universal basic income. So again, I'm going a little technical there, but if we just talk about guaranteed income, that does not say minimum standard of living. So in that sense, yes, Alaska will work with the guaranteed income literature and is getting closer to the guaranteed income literature and has always been, because it's cited everywhere as a sort of proxy to understand the unconditionality and the long-term effects. But in terms of the minimum standard of living, that comes from the UBI literature, which I don't think Alaska is.
Very interesting answer. Thank you very much.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that $3,000, which certainly hasn't been guaranteed yet, and never has really been a check that high. But if a family with four kids and two adults gets six checks times $3,000, that's $18,000, and you're living in a rural community, that certainly could count as a pretty basic income. Wouldn't you agree to that, Ms.
Balikrishna? So you're saying 3,000 every year or 3,000 every quarter?
It's 3,000 per year per person. So in a household of six people, that would be $18,000.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm just...
Again.
Yeah.
So is your question saying that if that does happen, that we have 3,000 per person per year, it can be considered UBI-ish? Yeah. For a family which is large enough? Is that your question?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, if the parents sort of abscond the children's checks, which legally they're allowed to do, then $18,000 does kind of start look like a UBI, as you call it.
Yes, probably. But then you have to look at what the standard of, like, sorry, I'm a researcher, so I think that way. But I would want to see what the minimum standard of living is per household, and depending on household size, to make a claim that, yes, it will be closer to guaranteed income or universal basic income. But but yes, if you have a household size of six and every person is getting 3,000, it will make their lives much, much better. And that household could be looked at from a UBI perspective. But again, given the fact that I cannot comment on, or I don't have data right now to try to estimate whether that's a minimum standard of living, I don't have the expertise right now to answer that question. But yes, guaranteed income literature, Alaska is always cited. It's been used in multiple ways to understand how an unconditional transfer to a citizen based purely on residency, which is also the most interesting part about Alaska's permanent fund program. All of that is used very, very frequently to understand what happens with unconditionality and long-term. But in terms of the actual amount, typically the way typically the way UBI is talked about is usually like $500 a month or $1,000 a month, and the current pilots and proposed pilots in the U.S. are using those amounts. So with that in mind, like every citizen getting $500 a month or every citizen or resident getting $1,000 a month, the Alaska Permanent Fund in terms of amount is, it does fall short in terms of the UBI literature, but that does not say anything about the value of, so what Alaska actually gives us is looking at long-term effects and what happens when you give something to a citizenship based on just you are a resident of this this locality and what happens when you know that you're going to get this money. So that's why Alaska is unique, and in the sense that that's the only, as far as I understand, the only study where we can actually look at long-term effects of what happens when you're giving someone an unconditional, no end date kind of cash transfer.
Right. Thank you. And I have a follow-up, and it's either for you and or the bill sponsor. But my understanding is the reason that the subject of payments over time instead of one lump payment was to curb certain activities or certain payment spending habits of the recipient, i.e. blowing the money in a short period of time, or causing certain social problems by giving people a lump sum and maybe people not showing up for work for a while, or people abusing substances that now they can have more disposable income to purchase. So that was my understanding, was sort of to change certain social behaviors. There's always a spike in domestic violence, there's a spike in other types of behaviors when the permanent fund check goes out. So, and I may be corrected by the bill sponsor, but I thought that was some of the behavior we're trying to get away from. So when you suggested that it's an opt-in or opt-out, to me that was a little concerning, because I would think the people that would probably best benefit from a timed payment would be those that may not choose a timed payment. They might say, I want all the cash now, the money now. So I guess my question to you, in a universal basic income experiment that's being tried in different countries or in Stockton, as you mentioned, I can't imagine that you would offer someone who's getting $500 a month to say, hey, here's your choice, $500 a month so you can pay your bills and supplement your living, or take $6,000 right now and we trust that you'll spend it wisely. I don't think you give that option to anybody, do you?
In terms of evidence, there is ample evidence now to an extent that it's very hard for me to, I have to defend this all the time. There is evidence to say that cash transfers do not increase temptation goods being drugs and alcohol and cigarettes. There's ample evidence saying that people do not use that money unwisely, in the sense because these are extremely constrained households who are trying to make ends meet. So to say that this is a way to change how people would spend the money if it was given to them in a lump sum versus frequent, I don't agree with that. My reasoning for making it an opt-in for a higher frequency is just because we don't know people's lives. Like, people's lives are extremely nuanced to an extent that their constraints are not known to me as an academic sitting in New York City. I do not know what their constraints are. So in order for us to make sure that we as policymakers or we as academics studying policy can actually influence or help people's lives, for me, the way I think about it is people are the best judge of their own lives. And if they get it more frequently or they get it in lump sum, should be their decision. So that was my perspective from where I was coming from. I was not coming from any sort of stand saying that I want to have a behavioral nudge to change the way people are using the money. For me, it's just that people know best, and we should let them make their choices.
Follow up.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, you stated that you find that lump payments don't increase temptation purchases, as you cited. Have you looked at Alaska statistics, or is that just in general? Because I think we've heard that there is certain behaviors certainly are documented to have spiked shortly after checks go out, and anecdotally, you hear stories that certain areas or certain behaviors do increase, and I think there are statistics to show, say, for example, domestic violence and stuff like that does rise. So is your research, Alaska gets cited in sort of UBI type studies because we've had a regular payout, but have you looked into the behaviors in Alaska specifically, or you're citing them on a more large scale per basis?
No, I was citing it as social science literature and evidence across the world on temptation goods. I wasn't speaking to Alaska.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Ms. Balakrishnan. And I might ask if Commissioner Tangeman would be able to come forward and speak at a high level to some of the considerations with changing PFD disbursement frequency from a sort of technical and feasibility perspective. I also want to put on the record my intentions with this hearing, which is, as I noted earlier, I don't anticipate this bill to move. Retroactively to Representative Vance's question, this bill basically changes the disbursement frequency from lump sum annual to quarterly, period. That's what it does. But I think as this question attracts questions and interest from third parties, from Alaskans, from Clem Tillion, and from the Senate, there's a possibility that we'll further examine this through the interim, and I wanted to have this hearing and notice this bill to sort of have something of a launching off point for the possibility of further consideration in the interim as PF and PFD questions are further examined. So that's a little bit of context. Thank you for joining us, Commissioner Tangeman. Would you be able to put yourself on record and speak to these technical considerations?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wool, Representative Hopkins. Usually don't get to name all the representatives, but nice small group today. For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Commissioner, Department of Revenue. Been a very interesting discussion. I was surprised by some of the comments the previous speaker made. It is an interesting discussion for sure. I'm not sure how much of a quarterly or a monthly issue has been, you know, discussed in the past. But certainly this year it's been heated and of interest, because when there was talk of a full dividend and PAC pay and, you know, $6,700 per person going out the door in October, I think it did generate this question, which is good. I think it's a great discussion to have. I've got several different thoughts here. I'll bounce around a little bit and you can just tell me when to stop talking. But just a couple facts. You know, we've been distributing dividends for 37 years. 1982 to last year, the low was $331 in 1984. The high was 2072 in 2015. Was never discussion about how to distribute it. It was just it goes out in October. I think one of my folks in the department pointed out that they thought the discussion on when to distribute ended up in October, because a lot of the rural folks, the rural villages, might be using that for heating fuel and things like that they need to get in before rivers freeze up, etc. I don't know how much of that went into the decision in October, but it does kind of make sense for a lot of folks. There were a couple different or interesting points. The opt-in, we can talk about that, obviously. From my perspective, I've worked in the Department of Revenue before. I've worked extensively on oil taxes. I've worked on a lot of different issues. And I always like to point out, especially when I worked for the Senate for the last couple of years, everybody has a lot of good ideas in this building. There's a lot of smart people. Everybody has good intentions. They come up with some really good ideas. And then you gavel out and you go home, and then the administration's left to put that good intention, implement it. Something along with this issue is certainly cost, technical challenge. One of the first things I always ask myself is, what's the goal? Why are we doing this? If it's a $1,600 dividend like it was last year, is the goal to really distribute $400 four times? And what is that goal? Why are we doing that? You've got two very vast different opinions on this. You got on one side, it's, you know, it's my money, give me my money, get the hell out of the way, government. Don't tell me how to spend my money. And then on the other side, you're going to have, you know, it's important to help people manage their money. And especially as these dividends grow, maybe they are blowing it on things that are not good for them, I guess. For some, I'm sure that's true. Not for everyone. But along the good intentions and the implementation side, I'll talk to some of the technical challenges. I think a lot of folks mistakenly think we push a button and 650,000 warrants go out, either direct deposit or checks. A lot of work goes into this. And some of our biggest concerns are obviously the cost. Instead of doing this for 650,000 distributions once a year, we'd be doing it for over 2.5 million times. Obviously, direct deposit's a little easier than checks, but it's still going through the process. The dividend division itself has been ramping down the number of employees. We're trying to go as paperless as possible. We're getting more people applying online, more with direct deposit. That's all good. But it also, as we reduce the size of staff, they have particular jobs to do, but then it's kind of an all hands on deck when applications come in, and then come September and October when it's time to distribute. So if we're doing this quarterly, we're going to have to basically beef up the division substantially, because this is going to be happening four times a year. And instead of people working on several different issues, but then kind of coalescing around those big, big, busy times of the year, they'll have to specialize in their individual areas.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I disagree with that partially, because right now you say when the applications come in, you all get together, and then when they go out in October, you disband. But the applications would still be once a year. It would just be the disbursement that's another three times. So that would maybe require less hands, because you're not all opening envelopes and entering. You know, the applications still would come in once and have a deadline and all that. So
yeah,
the front end would stay the same.
I might have misspoken there, Representative Wool. They coalesce when they come in, but then they also coalesce around the process of getting the payments out. And then, you know, that's, we're not even talking about the other issues. A lot of people, dividends, you get your check in your bank account, and that's it. We have thousands of individuals in the child support garnishment situation alone. Checks are garnished for several other reasons, legal reasons, court findings. You have garnishment issues. So we can do that once in October. We distribute the checks. We hold back what needs to be garnished. We distribute it to the thousands of caseloads and here and there. And then we're done. That's another issue that will be a year-round issue now, four times a year. So that would be a big issue. Pick, click, give, the education lottery. How would that be affected? If you're only getting $400 every 4 or 3 months, are you going to be as generous in your pick, click, give donation? I don't know. But those are interesting things to certainly look into. Let's see, what else? Oh, the opt-in issue that was brought up. Again, great intention. But, you know, for 650,000 people, it's our system isn't meant, it was never built. Again, we've been doing this consistently for 37 years. So the system was built for a one check out the door once a year. So there will be substantial costs in reprogramming, et cetera. I don't know what that is right now. But again, if through the interim as we work on this, I think we'll be able to shed more light on that. What else? Oh, Permanent Fund Corp. I've sat in the room here for a couple different hearings on it, a couple different issues, and the Permanent Fund Corporation itself comes up, and, you know, they'd like to hear from Angela. As a Permanent Fund trustee, we're neutral on all these issues, as Angela would tell you the same thing. It's their big concern was putting a POMB in place, so they knew exactly what their cash requirements were. Now they know they can calculate, you know, very closely what they need to make available for the next fiscal year. How it's spent is not the Permanent Fund Corporation's business or their desire to get into those discussions. It's they send money to the government, and then the government splits either for government or dividends, which is the discussion we're going through right now. So I think, and we go through that all the time. They think we're the Permanent Fund Corporation, and they think Angela's the person that cuts the checks for the dividends. So it's a common mistake. But I guess are there questions, sir? I could ramble for a while, I guess.
Representative Hopkins.
I already have.
I think there's a lot of fun mental exercises with this bill to discuss for sure. So two questions. You said you're one of the Permanent Fund Corporation trustees, absolutely, yeah. If we gave out a quarter of the size of the check four times of the year, there would be more money staying in the earnings reserve for that disbursement, so we would have greater earnings power over the other 9 months of the year before the full amount is given out, correct?
Yes, sir. And, in fact, last year was the first POMV distribution, and they actually put in place a very elegant way to do that. There was a lot of discussion about the CBR earns a point, 2 points maybe. We're earning double digits in the permanent fund, especially if you're looking at private equity. There's some really, significant earnings taking place. So the way you all sat this up last year, I thought was very elegant. It gave the Department of Revenue and the Permanent Fund Corporation the ability to figure this out. What's the most efficient way to draw to basically make cash calls as the needs arise? Now, obviously, in October, we need a significant amount for dividends, But otherwise, we drew down from the CBR first this fiscal year at the beginning of July, and we didn't start making cash calls to the permanent fund for POMB draws until in the fall after the dividend, actually. And they'd be $250 million cash calls. It wasn't just taking it all out. So I think it worked out really well, just leaving the department and the corporation to figure out the best way to do it. And they seem to have come to a pretty reasonable solution. Draw down the CBR first, and then make cash calls on the from the corporation. Now, if you don't have a CBR vote and we don't tap the CBR, it'll be slightly different because we're going to have to start making cash calls sooner from the earnings reserve. But again, we're not going to draw it out all at once either.
Interesting. Follow up?
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. The Ed King, the state's economist, friend of mine, like the guy, he was talking about, which I do, was talking about how there would be a big jump in jobs right around October when the dividend comes out. There was some concern from Meister that it would be a shorter-term job. It might not last year-round. With your economist hat on, do you see that this might help stabilize that economy to make those jobs last longer and be less of a bump and more of a stable economy?
Through the chair, Representative Hopkins, I have a minor in economics. So it's a tiny hat that I'll put on. But that's an interesting part of the discussion because I think a lot of folks think that, you know, you give the dividend in October, they blow it on a TV, they blow it on a vacation. It's, you know, how much actually stays in state? I think some people think the theory is if you do it quarterly, more money will stay in state. I don't really have an opinion whether that's true or not, but it is an interesting thing to study, I think, as we talk about this issue, especially if the dividend's getting, you know, if it were a $3,000 mm-hmm. dividend. That would be interesting to see if a quarterly payment would keep that money in state more.
Thank you. Well, we'll consider this the launching off point.
All right.
Appreciate you being available, Commissioner. There almost certainly will be an additional state affairs hearing before the 121st legislative day on Wednesday. We don't know when it will be, so stay posted. And I think that covers it as far as PSAs. So thank you. Representative Wald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well,
the good of the order?
Well, it's about this bill we're just discussing, which, since there wasn't a presentation, I don't really know what the impetus is. I hear it in the hallways a little bit, and that's what my question to the woman from New York was about behaviors and trying to change certain behaviors, binge spending and other types of activities. Is that the goal? And hearing Mr. Tangeman talk about the administrative difficulties, and it makes total sense to me that it's going to add much to their workload and other agencies that garnish, and I can see it being difficult. And a $1,600 check isn't that much to space out, and that's our highest one we've ever paid is $2,000. So, I mean, these aren't, you know, $12,000-$15,000 a year checks. So, I guess, is the goal to change behaviors? And as I stated before, there is a spike in certain kind of bad activities around dividend time once a year. So if it was a four-time-a-year check, would there be four spikes? You know, we wouldn't want that. Even $400 can, you know, I don't know, or $500 or whatever it happens to be. So I guess in a sentence, and we can get to this later, what is the goal of having quarterly payments?
Representative Wohl, as the sponsor of the bill, there's not so much a predestined goal that I have for the legislation. So unlike most of the bills that come through this committee, I'm not rearing to move this through, and it's not predetermined in my own mind that quarterly disbursements is necessarily good public policy given the amount or the size of the dividend at present. However, I feel like I have a lot to learn about it, and there's a lot of questions, some of which I think we've kind of bookmarked today that would be helpful to examine. So this is sort of truly, I think, a vehicle for conversation and inquiry rather than, as the sponsor of the bill, I think this is really good public policy, let's put it into law. Does that help clarify?
Yeah, it does. But, and I guess I've heard, as I've said earlier, that there are people that are concerned about giving everyone a big, for some people, a big check, and what their spending behaviors and other behaviors will be as a result. And that's where you hear about, well, let's space it out to try to curb some of those behaviors. And I didn't know if there's research to back that up or is it anecdotal. I have heard of the increase in domestic violence and maybe other certain criminal activity around that time or antisocial activity. So I guess if we were to go forward or when we go forward, I'd like to hear from that, the behavior side, not just the sort of administrative side as we heard today. But yeah, it's a fascinating topic. So
yeah, Representative Wohl, those I think those experts are out there. Muchin Katabi at ICER and his co-author Brent Watkins, if I'm getting the last Brent somebody rather from ICER, I think have done a study, and there's a couple of other folks in the lower 48. Stanford University has a small team that studied this. That I think if and when there's an additional hearing, it's definitely my intention to sort of bring that into focus and better understand what the literature is. I mean, to speak to the arguments put forward by, I mean, I think the most prominent individual in Alaska, who I know is boosting the idea of more frequent disbursement, Clem Tillion, his motivation in boosting the idea, and I don't know how grounded this is in academic research versus what he's observed anecdotally or otherwise, is, I think, in the words that Ms. Balakrishnan used, consumption smoothing. And Clem, and I think we should bring him in and he can testify whenever that future hearing is, would say he feels a lot of money leaves the state immediately through large bulk purchases or Disneyland or Hawaii or vacations or whatever. So that's Mr. Tillion's motivation, at least as he's described it to me and others.
Yeah, well, last point.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I found it interesting that the Ms. Balakrishna said that her studies have shown no increase in temptation spending, which anecdotally we certainly hear around here. And I've had family members that have lived in bush villages where they observe a lot of temptation spending after dividend, and in Fairbanks as well. And you know, I have employees that I don't see for work for a month or so after a dividend check, and you know, I get it. So it'd be interesting to delve deeper into this.
Point of order, you had employees?
I'm going to sustain that point of order. Congratulations, Representative. Okay, well, I think we got that all out there. We're adjourned. Next meeting is TBA. It's 12:31.